All right, this is CS50, and this is week 11, our very last, and you're curiously somehow our second. But it's great to see everyone here again. And the goal today is severalfold. Among the goals for today is to introduce you to applications of computer science in the real world by way of virtual reality. And we'll do that by way of CS50 itself, a bit of gaming, as well as by the world of archaeology, something that I myself took an interest in back in grad school. And we'll get, hopefully, a bit of emotional closure. Indeed, if you think back on what we've been doing this whole semester, whether you took some CS class before this or not, I mean, this class is entirely about problem solving. And the thing I would encourage you to keep in mind is that no matter how cryptic C might have felt, or no matter how you might have struggled with Flask or Python or any of the particular implementation details of problem sets, at the end of the day, everything we did really boils down to this mental model. And so truly, if you walk away with nothing else from CS50 other than this appreciation that even though you might not necessarily know in advance what goes inside that box, algorithms are the solution. I mean, most everything we humans do, with or without computers, can be reduced to this form of problem solving. And realize, too, that just 12 weeks ago, 73% of you had never taken a CS course before. And then you went through Scratch, and then C, and then memory management, and then implementing your own hash table or try and your own web-based application, and soon your own final project. So I dare say that no one here is among those less comfortable anymore. Indeed, what ultimately matters now is not so much where you end up relative to your classmates, but where you all end up today in this week 11 relative to where you were in week 0. Indeed, it's worth noting that most of the courses teaching fellows and course assistants were exactly where you were just a year ago today. Indeed, I thought we would hit play on a short film that the staff has put together to paint a picture of exactly what it's been like for them since graduating from CS50. I give you CS50 staff for fall 2016.
I'm Analia, and this is CS50.
Thank you so much to this year's staff, without whom the course really wouldn't be what it ultimately is for students. Indeed, more than just videos and problem sets and tests and quizzes, CS50 really is about the interpersonal experience that students have with the course and that connection that they make with the whole teaching staff.
So as a student, I really struggled to learn pointers, but I had a great TF, and he was just so inspiring that I really wanted to join the team myself.
When I applied to Yale, I was an English sociology prospective double major, and now I'm a computer science major. So if that's a little bit about how much CS50 changed me.
You can come in, take the class, do well, and even know the material so well that you're teaching the next year.
CS50 is one of the best opportunities you're going to have here while you're an undergraduate to teach a course to your peers and to really be a leader amongst your peers.
When you teach something, you're able to gain like 10 times as much knowledge as when you just learn it.
I've become much more comfortable with computer science fundamentals just by teaching them rather than taking classes on them.
And it's really amazing to watch these like incredibly bright-eyed, incredibly enthusiastic, just fresh out of high school students learning about CS and asking these really intense, really detailed questions in sections and just getting really excited about the material with me.
It's for that aha moment when you're helping a student in office hours and they've been struggling for hours and all of a sudden they get it, and it's that moment that I think is really special.
We are super, super excited every year when we have new people apply for CAs and TFs and graders, and being on staff is like the most fun part of CS50 and has been super, super defining of my whole experience at Harvard.
To my students, I'd like to say,
you're alive.
I love you all.
You guys are great.
And comment your code.
You should be a TF for CS50 to be able to empower other people. It's as simple as that.
Allow me to take a moment now to thank a number of members of the teaching staff, among them Maria and Walter, Doug and Alec, Rob, Zamyla, and truly CS50's whole team. In fact, if you've never actually clicked on the staff link on CS50's page, thanks to Luke and the production team, you'll actually see the biggest abuse of animated GIFs ever. But it brings to life the entirety of CS50's team here. And so thank you so much to the entirety of our staff, our teaching fellows, course assistants, producers, everyone here in Sanders who's been helping helping us out all term, and everyone who's been helping us out even before this term. In fact, one of the most frequently asked questions at CS50 lunches or whenever I've chatted with folks one-on-one has been essentially along the lines of, and we just got this question today, what's with the weird black and white dramas at the end of lectures? And indeed, if you haven't noticed, at the end of most every lecture is a little vignette inspired, in fact, by Citizen Kane, a film that you may have seen. And even if not, it's meant to, when watched contiguously, to tell a CS50 variant of that same story. And even if you haven't watched them all, they're all on CS50's homepage, but we thought we'd give you a bit of emotional closure with the last such scene, wherein it is revealed what Rosebud is. If you have no idea what it is you just watched, that's fine. Take a look at CS50's homepage, where all of them are now concatenated together. What you may have noticed, either from our first week's lecture or from some of the videos that have been going online over the course of the term, is that there's been this thing here, this special camera that has 8 lenses on it. Because for the first time this year, we thought we would try to push the envelope a bit technologically, bringing into the classroom a new form of technology that you've perhaps seen gaining steam in gaming and in industry more generally, virtual reality, or VR, which is a technology that allows a human to either, in simplest form, take their mobile phone and pull up Facebook or YouTube or the like and sort of see around them the entirety of some three-dimensional space just through the lens of that rectangular region. But better yet, if you actually put on a special headset like Google Cardboard or Samsung Gear or Oculus Rift or HTC Vive or bunches of others, you can actually transport yourself virtually to a space like that. So if you've been wondering what it's been like to sit in on lectures all year round in Sanders, you can actually go back and relive that experience. Thanks to this kind of camera here. And in fact, I can draw attention to it in the photograph here. And I can also draw attention to CS50's own Connor Doyle, a sophomore who joined us just over a year ago on CS50's team. In fact, we met him at Visitas, and he came up as pre-frosh were wont to do, expressing an interest in getting involved in CS50 goings-on since he's been an aspiring filmmaker and technophile. And so he actually joined CS50's team last year, has been taking CS50 this semester, and has been our go-to guy for all things virtual reality among, as well as alongside CS50's home production team. And so I thought it would be appropriate, given how much time the team has spent on this technology, in large part not so much to simulate what it's like for Harvard students or Yale students to experience classes in Sanders Theater. But there's this whole outreach effort these days by way of a program called AP CS Principles, which is a new AP course from the College Board that high school students around the world can start taking in satisfaction of an AP credit. And CS50 is just one of the implementations of that new course. Code.org, UC Berkeley, and others have theirs. And so really, the overarching goal of this kind of technology is to give a window into a classroom that high school students or adult students online couldn't otherwise participate in from such afar. So allow me to invite up CS50's own Connor Doyle. Welcome to Connor.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
And while we get something set up, would someone like to volunteer to be a participant in CS50 VR, putting on his or her face virtual reality goggles? I can't quite see that many faces with the lights. Okay, right here. Okay, come on down. Wonderful. And tiptoe past the camera. There we go. All right. Connor's getting things set up. And what's your name?
Jonathan.
David, nice to meet you. Come on over here. And so if we put you center here, Connor, as we get Jonathan set up here, what is it we are about to do, and what is it he's about to experience?
Sure. So the Nokia Ozo camera has 8 sort of sensors on it, and it's capturing the entire world. So wherever you are on stage right now, it's capturing you. And you can't really escape it. So what we're doing is we're taking the HTC Vive, which is a room scale VR experience, one of the best headsets on the market, I think, right now, and we're gonna put it on you, and we're gonna go back to week zero, and you're gonna relive sort of week zero experience with this sort of HTC Vive headset.
And so after each lecture, what CS50's production team is essentially this. It's a little washed out on the screen here, but it's 8 images from each of the lenses. And then using special software, do they stitch it together in such a way that the resulting image is essentially a video that's a full 360 degrees. In fact, the reason it looks distorted here is because once you put the headset on, does it wrap that world around your head so that if Jonathan looks up, down, left, or right, his eyes are actually going to be seeing something a little different. So we'll change the screen here to Connor and Jonathan's setup. So you are seeing now, if we could perhaps dim the lights, what Jonathan is seeing on his own headset. So this is week 0. This is CS50.
A little meta.
There was Connor's introduction to the intellectual enterprises of computer science and the art of programming. And my name is David Malin, and I was just thinking this morning that it's been, amazingly, 20 years today since I last sat where you guys do
so
now.
So you'll notice, too, it's a little hard to see the touch screen from the headset. So if you look toward the screen and now look down,
you'll see that it's digitally superimposed there, so that for code especially, you can see it
was kind of like,
all the more
realistically. I mean, I was a bit of a geek growing
up. All right, well, thank you to Jonathan. Let me bring you back to reality if we can.
To just be a whole bunch of people programming all the time.
Thank you. Welcome back. We have time for maybe one or two other demos. Would a second volunteer like to come on up now that you know what you're getting? Oh, now their hands are going up. Let's see, a little farther back, a little farther back. Okay, waving at me there in the jacket. Come on down. All right, come on down. So it's a little harder to justify this one academically, but you'll see artistically what's truly possible in this virtual reality and space. In fact, the game or the program we're about to see, Tilt Brush, allows you to paint not just in a two-dimensional space, but in a three-dimensional space, so that once painted, you can actually step in and around whatever it is you have created. What's your name?
Mariana.
Mariana, nice to meet you. Let me introduce you to Connor.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Hi.
Awesome. I'm just going to drop this on your face. Careful.
We can start a really, really long line afterwards, perhaps, to play, but...
Oh, this is a game?
Yeah. And this time, we're going to give to Mariana hand controllers that will allow her to physically move and manipulate this three-dimensional space and not just sit there experiencing what it was like. So if we could dim the lights here, too, you'll see digital representation of the game controllers, essentially, that are in Mariana's hands here.
Walk around.
I can go inside of it?
Yeah, if you look...
You want to go ahead and spell something out?
I thought I
would. Okay.
This is my name.
In a really big circle, yeah. Oh, nice. And now notice you have a few feet.
I can go.
You can go a few feet.
Ooh.
And notice you can look around in that three-dimensional space, because what we have on this stand here and this stand over here are little sensors that are essentially talking to the hand controllers that Mariana has, and it's figuring out, relatively speaking, her position in space. Very nice. You're not coming back, are you? Okay. All right, a big round of applause if we could for Mariana. Thank you.
That was so cool. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. And can we get one more volunteer, and then we'll move? Okay, two hands right here. Come on down. What's your name?
I'm Joseph.
Joseph. All right, Connor. What do we have in store for Joseph?
So this is my favorite game coming up. This is essentially Fruit Ninja in VR. So basically, what that means is, you're going to be getting like samurai swords and you can just like slice a through. It's awesome. Wicked. So we'll get this up real quick. One moment. There we are.
All right.
Okay. So yeah, if you drop that on your head, on your eyes. There you go.
All right.
And
put this behind you.
I'll give you the samurai swords. So if you step forward now and hit, if you look, did you remove the cable? That isn't
hot. Stand by.
Isn't helpful. One moment. There we go.
Do we have to?
Yeah, it's just gonna.
There we go.
There we go. We're back.
All right. So if you've never played this game before on iOS or Android, the goal is simply to slice fruit.
So
1 second.
I see nothing.
But we see everything.
1 sec. We've got this. All right.
Here we go.
Resetting. Revamping.
We're rebooting. All right, Fruit Ninja. Splash screen's coming up.
Yes. We're back. Here we go.
All right. All right.
So if you look and slice the banana, arcade.
There we go. Turn them on.
And
there we go.
Woo. Arcade.
Hold on, hold on.
We're back! That's basically it.
All right. All right, well, thank you. You have to be comfortable, by the way, being on the internet, so. Well, now,
thank you.
Something to share at home. Thank you. And special thanks to Connor as well. So truly, this initiative and this experimentation with new technologies in academia is in large part, in our case, inspired by our friends in the archaeology department. In fact, just a year ago today, CS50 and myself included had no idea what it would mean for us to produce CS50 in virtual reality. But we reached out to our friends in the archaeology department with who had been experimenting with this technology in Egypt and in actual environments where it makes all the more sense to be able to transport humans to places they might not be able to go and experience virtually what it might be like to be inside of a tomb or inside of a pyramid or museums that not everyone in the world could otherwise access. And I'll admit a personal fancy for this field. I had a sort of mid-grad school life crisis some years ago where I started wondering, why am I doing my PhD in computer science and not archaeology? And that's because of the inspiration of friends like ours, like Professor Peter Manwelian, who will come now up and introduce us to the world of VR in Egyptology. Thank you.
All yours. Emotional closure and fruit slicing. I'm not sure I can match that, but I'll do my best. So I'm going to take you back into the past. And just while he was thinking, why didn't he go into archaeology, I'm thinking, why didn't I go into computer science? All right. I'm going to take you to my favorite place in the world, outside of Harvard Square, of course, which is the Giza Pyramids, a place I've been involved with for quite some time. And this is all about using the tools of the future, what you're doing, to study the past, basically. The great golden age of archaeology worked at the pyramids for many, many decades, and you can see it's still going on. The black and white shot is really from the Indiana Jones days, and then down below is a recent photograph. Why do we go back to this place? Because there's still a lot of really cool stuff there. There are tombs all around the pyramids from about 2500 BCE, and these tombs are loaded with scenes and statues and anything you want to know about ancient Egyptian culture and civilization. It's all there in frozen moments on the walls. There are gorgeous small objects that have come out of these tombs, and there are museums all over the world. And then there's big stuff too. There's hidden temples under the sand, fantastic pyramids, private structures as well, and some of the great statuary that we've ever found. These are in the Museum of Fine Arts, and you may have seen them. We owe all of this to one guy. And do you know where that photograph was taken? Right outside that door. Yes, this is the class of 1889. And my predecessor was George Reisner. And there you can see him in his class photo. In those days, they took them right outside the doors of Mem Hall. So this is the guy who created something called the Harvard University Boston Museum of Fine Arts Expedition. And all of you should be feeling justly proud of a 40-year expedition that worked at 23 different sites up and down the Nile. I'm just going to talk about the Giza Pyramids up towards the top of this map here, but everything in red that you see is a Harvard MFA expedition site. So this guy died at the pyramids in 1942, and he's actually buried in Cairo, but he left behind a massive archaeological archive, and it's full of stuff like this. And so problem solving, as David was saying at the beginning of the hour here, this is basically all about problem solving. So how do we take this incredible archaeological archive that's locked up in boxes and rolled drawings and diaries and typescripts and glass plate negatives, how do we make that accessible? How do we study the past in ways that we haven't been able to do before? And there's great stuff here. There's register books. On the right, that's the SQL database of its time, right? Enter every object, give it a drawing, give it a number. Diaries that describe what they did every single day. Photographic registers, and that's what we did. We started out making databases of all of these things. This is way back in the year 2000, and thanks to the Mellon Foundation in New York and about $3.5 million. So it's linking, it's intelligent connections between all these diverse types of data. Photographs, drawings, diaries, statuary, records, notes, cards, everything. All of it's centered in the middle there around the tomb that relates. So pick a certain tomb, find out what we got. What do I mean by that? Let's walk it through one particular piece. So here's a statue lying in its burial pit as it was found in 1936. We find it, we take it up to the dig camp, which by the way, behind the pyramids was called Harvard Camp. We take photographs of it in glass plate negatives. There you see the statue of the standing male from the fifth dynasty. It gets entered in the diary record for what happened that day in April of 1936. Then we have the SQL database, right? The object register book where it gets a sketch and a description and measurements and photographic negative numbers and all that. Plan and sections of the tomb shaft, of the pit that actually came from. Preparing up the manuscript for publication eventually. And then the big decision, does it go off to the Cairo Museum? Does it come all the way back to Boston? And the packing list tells you what went where. And eventually this particular statue came back to Boston and you can see it today in the Museum of Fine Arts. So our database, and there's a sample page on the right, which is pretty confusing looking, and we're working on something better now right here at Harvard. That's the page that would link the tomb and all the associated data. So you could do any kind of faceted search on the items that you see down on the right-hand column there. Who are the people related? What are the objects? What are the photographs? What are the drawings? What's unpublished? What's published? All of that together. So the relationships get pretty complex, as you can imagine. And here's one of our little site maps that shows us each of those blue balloons, the big ones, would be a site or a tomb. And you can see all the stuff spinning off of it, related items that allow you for faceted searching. And the more items there are, the more granular that you can get. So problem solving, how do you take this traditional archaeological archive and put it in some kind of organized arrangement that for today's technology will make it useful for scholars? So here's our layout of our forthcoming website and all the different pull-down menus and options that we're trying to do. And we did create this Giza website. You can see the URL at the top there. That's where the traditional data is. Then we teamed up with a 3D modeling company in Paris called Dassault Systèmes, and we said, why don't we build a 3D model of the entire site of Giza? And my megalomania was, of course, to try to put every single tomb and every statue and every ceramic pot back in place eventually. Well, we're not there yet, but we're getting there. So down below, this website is also fairly old now, and it only works on PCs, unfortunately, not Macs, and we're working on something new. So the goal is to combine the traditional data up top and the 3D data down below into a new Harvard-owned, Harvard-hosted Giza website. And that's where the computer technology comes in. So it's Studio Max and Maya and programs like this, starting with the archaeologically responsible maps and plans and drawings, creating wireframe renderings of these tombs and the statues and the objects, and then putting them together and adding textures and adding realistic appearances. So here's a cluster of tombs on the west side of the Great Pyramid. You can see the original archaeologist plan drawings there in front. From there, we get to this, and we get some pretty realistic and amazing things. Now you can start to experience a place like the Giza Plateau in ways that a human being can't when you go to the site itself. We can study what's above ground. We can study the burial shafts that are down below. I always dream of this, what I call the tomb's eye view of Giza, being underground in the limestone bedrock and looking upwards. So we launched all of this material a few years ago, and it got tremendous worldwide press in lots of different languages, and now we want to take it further. So it's time to upgrade, and here's a sneak peek at what I hope will be launched next year, early next year, just a prototype of our new Giza website, and there you can see the 3D model that we've created. So there's a teaching classroom above the geological lecture hall where we do this in VR. Students come in, put on the 3D glasses, and experience the model this way. And it's not just a video, it's a real-time model. So I can dive down a shaft or go to the left or go to the right, whatever it is that they want to experience. It's a pretty cool way to look at the site. The next step, of course, is what you've just seen, is to take it to the headset level and then get it out of the classroom and make it accessible all over the place. So to do this kind of thing, you've got to study the reaction, the focus groups, and here's just a sample of one of our sample users who would then use the web, try to search for something for a school report, maybe go on the website. What pages would they go to? Would they even end up at our homepage, or would they dive right in? We're studying this bit by bit, and we hope maybe some of you might be interested in checking this out and giving us your feedback at some point too. That allows us to lay out the various pull-down menus and how the searching should go. Suddenly, we're trying to be all things to all people, right? Someone who knows nothing about the pyramids but just wants to know, hey, what's cool here? Or a PhD candidate who's trying to do a dissertation on every statue of a seated female facing to the left on a tomb wall that's on the south or on the west side of the pyramid, trying to provide everything for everybody. So lots of cool stuff still to come, and my fantasy is that eventually everyone's got one of these headsets, whether it's Google Cardboard or HTC Vive or whatever. Wherever you are in the world, everyone logs into the same file, and we are all standing virtually together in front of the Sphinx, and I can be giving my lecture there. And then I'll say push button 2, and we'll go inside the Great Pyramid and continue the talk. So I want to leave you with just one other experiment that we did, which was kind of fun, and that's where the computer world has taken us back into the physical world. Normally you go from physical into virtual. We went backwards in this experiment. So in 1925, that area that you see circled right there was the site of an amazing discovery of a hidden, disguised burial shaft that went 100 feet down underground. And at the bottom of this was a chamber that had tons of stuff completely deteriorated and in tiny little bits. And it turned out to be the burial place of the mother of the king who built that great pyramid right to the right. Her name was Queen Hetepiris. And she had a lot of amazing furniture down there, but it was in tiny fragments because all the wood had deteriorated. So there were reproductions and restorations of some of her stuff, but this is the fanciest one. This is a throne or a chair. And it took about a decade for the archaeologists to make that reconstruction drawing. Could we maybe dim the lights a little bit and see the 3D model here? This is our 3D model of experiencing that chamber with everything restored. So now you see all the furniture, the bed canopy, the curtain box, the chairs, the carrying chair. And over on the right, that's the fancy chair with these amazing falcon arms and inlaid faience tiles and gold gilding. So we studied the original fragments. These are in the basement of the Cairo Museum, and tried to figure out, could we put this together? And yes, indeed we could. So we made 3D printing models from our computer model, nice tiny little ones. We should sell those in the shop someday. There's our 3D computer model of the chair, and we thought, can the computer actually drive the milling machines to actually make this thing? And sure enough, they can. So this is a CNC routing machine, a shop bot, and you see it's actually carving one of these lion-shaped legs, and there's the arm, the falcon is taking shape in this piece of wood, all made possible by ones and zeros, right? By the computer model originally created from archaeological plans and drawings into 3D Studio Max, and then out the other end as wood, and as gilding, and as faience tiles, which we created with the Ceramic Center across the river, and my thanks to Kathy King for her help there. And then, wouldn't you know it, we have a full-size gold and inlaid chair of Queen Hetepiris, which you can see in the Semitic Museum on Divinity Avenue anytime. Free admission, come by anytime and experience that chair. So the computers and the databases and the simulations and the VR are helping us go in all these different directions, ask new research questions we haven't been able to ask before, and hopefully get new answers as well. So some of my classes end up in this visualization lab classroom that I mentioned before, where in 3D, or even in aerial shots like Google Street View and Google Maps and things, we can experience the site as it is today, as it was in 1920 during a great discovery, or all the way back to the fourth dynasty, 2500 BC. It's great fun. And as I mentioned, the next step is to get it out of the classroom and into hands like yours, so you can all be experiencing this type of amazing immersive exposure to digital archaeology. Back at the site, we're involved with some other interesting projects too, such as shooting cosmic particle rays at the Great Pyramid right there. These are muons, and what they tell you is where there might be unknown cavities, corridors, and chambers inside the Great Pyramid. These have been announced in the news recently, and we have more work to do, but you're looking at the facade of the Great Pyramid, and all those little white dots are showing anomalies or voids where, who knows, there may be previously uncharted corridors and chambers. Stay tuned for more on that. So I'm also, in addition to professor of Egyptology, I'm the director of the Harvard Semitic Museum, and my goal is to try to blend the ancient artifacts with some of these new technologies in the galleries. So I hope next time you come, you'll be able to see touch tables and some of these VR experiences and ways to bring these ancient artifacts alive. And in previous years, we've actually listed the types of interesting projects and challenges that we face in the hopes that experts like you might want to get involved at some point and build some tiny little app here and there. I know we're a little late in the semester to take on any of this year, but keep these things in mind if it's something that you want to get involved with. Or just for more exposure to ancient Egypt, a couple of classes that are kind of fun. One is a gen ed class I do called Pyramid Schemes, and the other is just on the Giza Plateau, and those are coming up in the not too distant future. Why is this important? Why should we worry about this? Well, take a look at what's happening at the site and at these objects. Things that were in great condition as late as 1920 now look like this. So before, above, after, down below. Or over on the right, the beautiful paint on that sarcophagus, which today is in the Brooklyn Museum, and you'd never know it was decorated or painted. All of it is gone. So in many ways, you can study these archaeological sites better from the archives, from the photographs, from the VR reconstructions, from the immersive modeling, than you can even if you go out to the site or even if you look at the artifacts today. Which one of these things will survive longer than the other, do you think? I leave it to you to be the judge of that, right? How many devices do you have that just don't work anymore, or the disks that run in them don't play, or something's locked up and frozen on you? Well, down below, limestone rules. So I will finish with that. I thank you for thinking about the future, and I thank you for taking this course, and I also want you to think about the past and the future together and the ways that we can combine these tools and unleash not only where we're headed as a civilization, but where we've come from. Thanks very much.
Thank you. So in addition to acknowledging all of the course's staff who've been so involved behind the scenes, we wanted to take a moment and acknowledge some of the course's students by way of something that might offer us a bit of comfort, perhaps, versus this past weekend. Let me go ahead and open up a window here. So we have a few acknowledgments to make, and one of them we thought would be fun to do by way of this game here that will rematch Harvard against Yale and some others, for which we need, for just a moment, one volunteer. One volunteer. Some other hands? Any other hands back there? No? Okay, right. Okay, two hands, I guess, does it. Come on up. What's your name?
Arpith.
All right, Arpith's going to come on up, and from here we'll transition to later problem sets and a final look at, nice to see you, what lies ahead. So this is Ivy's Hardest Game by one of your predecessors. Come on around over here. I'm going to go ahead and click the green flag, as you may recall, from some 12 weeks ago. And if we can crank up the volume here. You're going to go ahead and press the space bar to start and use up, down, left, right arrow.
Can't touch this. Can't touch this. Can't touch this. Can't touch this.
So notice, of course, the loops that must be involved here, the if condition that just executed, the copy operation. Slightly faster. Very nice. The variables up to level 5.
Look in my eyes.
You have lives you can spend. Nice. Level 7.
Sound the bell. School is in, sucker. Can't touch it. Give me a song. A rhythm making them sweat. That's what I'm doing. They know. You're talking about the hammer. You're talking about a show that's hyped and tight. Singles are sweet.
Two words.
Nice.
Nice.
Either work hard or you
touch this. You can't touch this.
Second to last level, level 9. Level 10. Do it.
Can't touch this.
Look, man, it's beatable. You better practice. Because you know you can't touch this. Bring the bell, school's back in. Break it down. Try one or two more times. Two.
Stop. Have time.
All right, one more, one more. We'll post that online if you'd like to tinker as well. So you may recall that in addition to problem set 0, there was problem set 4, for which there was some icing on the cake at the end, whereby you were challenged to find as many of the computer scientists as you could. And we wanted to acknowledge a few of your classmates, Pedro, Vicky, and Mikhail, all of whom sent us quite a few selfies of the staff, beknownst or unbeknownst to them. So some fabulous prize awaits you via your email. In problem set 5, meanwhile, you'll recall that we had the big board, and this was an opportunity to try to minimize how much running time and how much space you ultimately use. It turns out that this year's big board was dominated largely by CS50's own staff, who were formerly students, at least, themselves, and had an extra year to refine their code. But we did want to acknowledge CS50's own Derek Wang for being atop the board among the students. So congratulations to Derek. You too will see something in your email as well. Now, you might recall this year was the first ever coding contest, which was either an opportunity for a well-deserved week off or to challenge your classmates with the number of coding problems that were available online, and you could work in teams of one or two or three or four. And we'd like to acknowledge the teams that ultimately ranked atop that big board in third place this year, which now feels a little dated, was We Miss You HUDs. Stay tuned to your email for a fabulous prize. In second place was the fabulous prizes. In first place was Big Board Big Boys. Congratulations to you. And the lucky raffle winner, which was drawn pseudo-randomly among all of those who participated, was Madeline. So stay tuned to your email as well. Now, there still remains a few things for everyone else here in the room, and that indeed includes the CS50 Hackathon. So at the CS50 Hackathon, you'll have an opportunity to arrive around 7 p.m. and depart around 7 a.m. and hopefully bite off a huge portion of your final project along the way, as well as partake after signing in Felipe's around 9 p.m., in Domino's around 1 a.m., and if still standing around 5 a.m., will we charter some Harvard shuttle buses and head to IHOP for breakfast. Meanwhile, throughout the evening, will the staff be building their own projects like this, decorating the space and all of the food and support structure that you might like, but ultimately it's this kind of opportunity, really one of those few collegiate experiences that hopefully you take with you for some time, this one focused alongside classmates and staff in accomplishing your very last goal for the term. So beyond that, there will be therapy dogs too. Picture here is Milo and Jordan and Maria from on stage. So take a look at this URL here. This will be on the course's website if you'd like to register in advance for that, and we'll follow up via email with more details. And then lastly is truly the climax of the course. Back in the day, would we do final project presentations in a fairly traditional way? Everyone gathers in their sections and everyone walks through their projects, and no one's all that inspired. And so a few years back, what we decided to do was to invite the whole campus. And so indeed, these days, do some 2,000 plus people attend, students and faculty and staff and even middle school students and high school students from the nearby area to come see what you have accomplished by term's end. And we'll set up a whole lot of tables. You'll bring your laptops. There'll be food, friends from industry, and more. And it will be quite the opportunity, ultimately, to take pride, we hope, in all that it is that you've accomplished this semester, just like your predecessors passed, and there will be cotton candy this year as well. So in all seriousness, we do hope that out of this class you have gotten a better appreciation for how to go about solving problems and some more tools in your toolkit, and hopefully ultimately all the more comfort and confidence in approaching those problems, whether they're inside or outside of computer science. Before we adjourn to the pub downstairs, where quite a bit of cake awaits, allow me to dim the lights one more time for fall 2016 and give you what was CS50. This was CS50, and cake is now served.